Good morning, good morning out there. How are you, how are you, how are you? As Arthur Godfrey used to say, someone none of you young people will remember. And probably I'm trying to forget too. Hey, it's the 7th month, the 14th day. Moon's day, all day today. Beautiful day out there. Sun's shining, grass is growing. Oh God, I got to mow that thing again. Anyhow, it's a great day, and we're still at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the show. Now, you should have your July donations for the show in by now, 15th. But sometimes you wait until the latter part of the month and send them in, and then we get them a little mixed up with the next month. And then that may benefit you, but don't benefit my bookkeeping. Well, we got big changes coming on here. Well, for Indiana, big changes. We're going to be changing our server tomorrow, and we've discovered that we can cut our expenses almost in half by changing servers and actually gain much faster access to the internet. So we're going to be doing that tomorrow. Now, if there's a problem to where you don't get a show tomorrow, well, don't blame me. We're going to have some people doing some work around here. So if not, you'll probably get something from merchandiseresist@yahoo.com the webmaster, She-Wolf, out there. So don't worry, we're still here. We're still here, yeah. Well, I saw this film advertised on the internet called America. And I thought it was a movie, fictional movie, you know, about some kind of breakdown in the country and how they climb back and beat old Zog and all that kind of stuff. But it turned out to be a documentary by this Indian fellow from India with the dot on his head. Well, no, he don't have a dot on his head, but he's got a big honker, I'll tell you that. He must like free air. Well, anyhow, so we drove to see it, and I don't know quite how to relate this to you, because it had some good stuff in it, some history that people didn't know and needed to know, some bad stuff, and it's definitely pro-capitalist. In fact, the Indian said that capitalism has raised 200 million Indians out of the squalor. Well, that was because capitalism moved American factories to India. And don't forget, India was under control of capitalism, otherwise known as the mercantile system, for a long time. And I don't think the average Indian would tell you that was such a great deal. So anyhow, there was a lot of areas where there were overstatements. Sometimes, it's wonderful, and all we have to do is just be good capitalists and everything's going to be all right. Well, I believe in free enterprise, and I think most of the time when he was talking capitalism, I was thinking free enterprise. And he was talking about the great entrepreneurial spirit of white people, basically, you know. Sure, he talked about slavery and stuff like that, but he also brought out that actually there were more blacks in slavery under black plantation owners than under white, which I was surprised that he said that, which is true. He brought a lot out about the Indians, too, the bad things we supposedly did to the Mongols that found themselves into North America, not native to North America, of course. But he was able to show that how they warred against each other. And if you'll get the book Crimson Prairie, you'll read a lot more about that. See, the Indians, the Mongols, could have won against the white Europeans. All the white Europeans had was those blunderbuss guns that took you 15 minutes to load one, and then they had no rifling. They weren't accurate at all. So if the Indian tribes had stuck together, they could have won easily. But what did they do? The first thing they did was went to work with the French and the English. Remember? French and Indian Wars? Right away, the Indians sold out their own future, their own tribes, to the white man. White man didn't force them to do that. So all this crap about the Mongols and how we just did terrible things. Anyhow, can you imagine the way the early settlers were in this country with those crummy rifles they had? If they had to really fight a guerrilla operation of Mongols swinging from the trees with machetes and tomahawks and bows and arrows, I don't think they could have beat them. I don't think they could have beat them. And if some people say, well, the whites, they had cannons. Well, how are you going to kill the enemy when, you know, there's one enemy in one tree and one enemy in the next tree? How many cannonballs are going to take you to get them all? No, I think the Indians, and plus half of them threw in the white flag anyhow, because they were offered blankets and food and free rent on the reservation, and they took it. And also how we took Mexico, he brought that out real well in the Mexican War, how we took Mexico, we forgave them. A $9 billion debt or something like that. and 90 million or something, forgave their debt and then gave them back their country. And in doing that, we kept that Southwest stuff. So anyhow, and why are they always bitching about us? Because Napoleon was in there long before Americans were in control of anything. So anyhow, it's an interesting film from a cinematic view. It was done very well. I think the guy had, I think he had basically good intentions. It seemed like it was a little bit bent more towards the Republican. They come out and blasted Hillary and Saul Alinsky and Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn was a socialist, but a lot of things Howard Zinn said were correct. And I can't stand this stuff that when one side's all correct and the other side's all wrong stuff. I don't buy into that. And also, they made socialism a dirty word. Well, I remind people that certain forms of Aryan socialism have been practiced for a long time around the world, and in many cases, they're quite successful. The capitalists keep pointing out the misuse of socialism under the Soviet, which was not socialism at all. It was nothing but state capitalism. And in Germany, the true national socialism was never allowed to really go all the way because right away they got involved in external warfare. And when you're involved in external warfare, you're just playing back into the hands of the super capitalist and the ruling class, as far as I'm concerned. So anyhow, it... I did notice one thing in this theater. We drove a few miles to find this theater, and there seems to be a new screen out. I don't know, maybe it's been out for a long time, but I noticed the screens at the theater in our town here. They're big enough, and they're acceptable, but these screens that I saw in this theater were exceptionally bright. I don't know whether it was rear projection or what it was, but I asked the people out at the ticket counter, but they didn't know shit from Shinola, so I couldn't find out. I said, how come your screens are so bright, much brighter than most theaters? So, any of you guys out there know about that? You could actually see the little dots, you know, real small on the screen that make up the picture. It's almost like it was... television, some type of television apparatus putting the movie on the screen. Well, anyhow, I want to go back to that theater because I love a really good picture and good sound when I'm going to watch a film. You might go see that, America, and let me know what you think. Obviously, it's not made to make us happy. But there's a lot of truth in it and some obvious falsehood. So there you go. That's showbiz, man. Well, I see our, I don't know what you call them, these Israeli Jews. God gave us this piece of land. It's ours, and we can do anything we want to with it. Our kicking the asses again of the Palestinians, who actually have more natural right to the land than the Jews ever did. And American press is still right in there siding with the Israelis, while thousands of people, millions around the world, are marching in the streets attacking Israel. All the major TV corporations tend to support Israel. But, I mean, it's getting harder and harder for these bastards to support Israel. Especially that the whole damn thing, Israel, like Colonel William Gale used to say, used to call them Israel lie, because everything they're based on is a total lie. I mean, including their King David, all that stuff. They've never been able to find any proof anywhere. They've dug up the whole damn country. Never found any proof that David ever existed or most of these people they yap about in the Bible ever existed. But you know as well as I do why it keeps going and why they get the power is Christianity. Without Christianity, Judaism would still be just nothing. It'd be just a small cult, you know, here and there, not able to give anybody much trouble. But the problem is that as long as Christianity is so strong and so inextricably connected to that hokum book, the Bible, Israel is going to, at least the Jews, are going to be maintain a certain amount of power. So really don't blame the Jews. Blame the Christians. Because, like I say, Judaism would have been just a small cult and could have been kept under control if they didn't get out of line, didn't get too much power like that. But Christianity, and don't say it just happened. It happened back in the Middle Ages, and they keep talking about the poor Jews, they were persecuted. Well, they were economically persecuting far more of the European people through their deals with the kings and Napoleon and all these people. Can you imagine that? I read that to you the other day, that Napoleon wanted to be taken to Jerusalem and made the king of the Jews. Boy, talk about a schizophrenic guy, because he was one time he's against the Jews, one time he's for the Jews. Unbelievable. You got to be one way or the other. But you got to keep them under control. But as long as Christianity is as strong as it is, the Jews are going to have power. That's where it comes from. So if anybody tells you different, they're full of bullshit. Oh, that's another thing that was screwed in that America documentary. Oh, Christianity did wonderful things. If we hadn't had Christianity, we'd be nowhere and all that kind of nonsense. That was the other bad part of the documentary. Well, you hear all this BS from Israel and the American press. Now, this is the son of an Israeli general who's Jewish. Let's listen to what he's got to say about it. He's coming up to the lectern. He's got his notes in front of him. He's almost ready to go. He wrote a book called The General's Son. You might want to get it from the library. Yeah.
Now, if we talk about the right of return of one nation, you'd expect that there would be, if we accept it as a principle, then you'd expect that we'd accept it in general, across the board. Yet when people talk about the right of return of Palestinians to their homeland, suddenly a red line comes up and everybody says, no, we can't talk about the right of return of the Palestinians. This has to be taken off the table. This is not negotiable. The right of return of the Palestinians is not acceptable. What's interesting about that is that the right of return of the Palestinians, we're talking about, quite often we talk about the actual people who had to leave their homes. And if they had already passed away, then we're talking about their direct descendants. People who still have the keys and the deeds to their homes, and quite often can go to the very spot where a village existed, where today there might be a highway, and will point out the mosque, and will point out the well, and will point out the door to their home. Yet they do not enjoy the right to return. So obviously, this is a double standard of immense proportions. The other thing BB talked about right off as he started was about King David, who reigned some 3,000 years ago, and, you know, and here we are today as his descendants. What's interesting is, besides the fact that there is no historical evidence that King David ever existed outside the Bible, which of course is not a historical document, and Israeli archaeologists have all but turned up the entire country to find proof that he ever existed. Today, as we speak, an entire town, an entire community is being kicked out of their homes and forced into exile through violence, in order to prove that King David existed in a place called Silwan. It's a community of 50,000 people right outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. Yet the world sees nothing wrong with this. American money is poured into this project to build what is called the New City of David, an archaeological park. And a community of 50,000 Palestinians has to be terrorized in order to leave. Their homes are being destroyed in order to make this point. This fictional, mythical connection between the ancient kingdom of King David and today's Israel. So these are just two examples. And it was interesting that Bibi Netanyahu decided to kick off his speech at the United Nations with these two things. But what I'd like to do today is just begin with a little bit of history. And if you go ahead and hit the first slide. Thank you. People talk about the fact that this conflict, the conflict in the Holy Land, the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians has been around for so long that it's really not something anybody can ever solve. It's been going on for thousands of years. People have been killing each other there forever. This is not true. And a good place to start, if we're going to talk about how this conflict began, a good place to start would be on the 29th of November, 1947. The day that the United Nations accepted the resolution to partition Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. And this ridiculous map is what they came up with. Now, when you look at this map, before you even hear about the details, before we even touch on the details of this map, just by looking at it, it's unbelievable that anybody expected that this would work. And of course, this didn't even last one day. In 1947, there were two communities living parallel lives. We had the Jewish community that numbered about 500,000, maybe a little bit less than 500,000, that were expecting and hoping to become a state. And you had the Arab community, the Palestinian Arab community, of about 1.5 million people who were also in the process and had the expectation of becoming a state. Yet when the United Nations came up with this ridiculous plan, they chose to give the larger portion of the country to the smaller community, to the Jewish community. And the smaller portion of the land to the larger community. And then people said, and to this day you hear people say, see, the Arabs, the Palestinians, did not accept the partition plan, so all this is their fault. Is anybody mad enough to think that they would accept this? Would anybody in their Palestinian in their place have accepted something like this? Obviously not. And obviously, like I said, this did not last even a single day. Because as soon as the resolution was accepted, the Zionist forces, what was called the Haganah, the Palmach, began a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing. Now the story that we hear, the myth that we're told about 1947, and I heard it once again today, earlier today, at the Seattle Times, is that in 1947, after the United Nations finally recognized the right of the Jewish people to have their own state, the Arab armies attacked, intending to destroy this fledgling state, this young Jewish community. And this is only several years after the Nazi Holocaust. Yet somehow, between the end of 1947 and the end of 1948, the Zionist forces were able to conquer almost 80% of the country, destroy over 500 towns and villages, including schools and mosques and churches and homes, and exile almost 1 million people within a 12-month period. How did they do this if they were being attacked by massive armies from the outside? But once again, when we look at the facts, we realize that in 1947, the Jewish community, the Zionist community, had quite a substantial military force. They had a force of close to 40,000 armed men. And well-trained, well-indoctrinated. My father was one of them. There was no equivalent on the Palestinian side. The Palestinians have never had a military force. To this day, the Palestinians have never had an army or a military force. There was no equivalent of the other side. The Arab armies, such as they were, didn't enter the war until late in 1940, May of 1948. Much of the ethnic cleansing had already taken place. The war had been taking place for over 6 months by then. So, of course, this is a myth. This is a myth that nobody takes the time to investigate and question. But once again, the reality that in the 12-month period, so much was done, exactly because that is exactly what was the purpose of these Zionist forces. To capture as much of the land as possible and get rid of as many people as possible. And that's exactly what they did. Would you hit the next one, please? You heard the story, Judith related to the story about my mother. That's my mother. She's 86 now. She's still living in Jerusalem. She was born and raised in Jerusalem. And she used to tell me how when she was young, she would walk around on a Saturday afternoon. And many of the beautiful neighborhoods in Jerusalem, and I'm talking about the new Jerusalem, the Jerusalem that was built outside the city walls. These were Palestinian communities with beautiful homes. And she would walk around and she would see the families on a Saturday afternoon sitting under the or by the lemon tree and so on. And then in 1948, she was living still in Jerusalem. These communities were forced to leave. Their homes were given to Israeli families. And she was offered one of these homes, and like you heard, she refused. The thought of taking another family's home just did not sit well with her. And then she saw the looting, and she still, to this day, when she talks about it, you can see that she feels such a sense of shame. But what's interesting is that I remember hearing this story as a child many, many years ago and over a very long period of time. And it wasn't until I was actually working on the book and I spoke to her about this again that I realized why this story was bothering me all those years. Because the story was bothering me. There was something about it that was troubling. And only now I realized it was troubling because it contradicted the national narrative. It contradicted what I learned in school. That the Arabs attacked, we won, they left, and we get the spoils. So what's wrong with taking their homes? If this is the truth, then there's no wrong in taking their homes. They attacked, and we won. Fair enough. But once again, like I said, hearing this story in the back of my mind over and over and over again kind of troubled me. And this is exactly why. The truth lays in the personal story, not in the national narrative. At the right of return of one nation, you'd expect that there would be, if we accept it as a principle, then you'd expect that we'd accept it in general, across the board. Yet when people talk about the right of return of Palestinians to their homeland, suddenly a red line comes up and everybody says, no, we can't talk about the right of return of the Palestinians. This has to be taken off the table. This is not negotiable. The right of return of the Palestinians is not acceptable. What's interesting about that is that the right of return of the Palestinians, quite often we talk about the actual people who had to leave their homes. And if they had already passed away, then we're talking about their direct descendants. People who still have the keys and the deeds to their homes, and quite often can go to the very spot where a village existed, where today there might be a highway, and will point out the mosque, and will point out the well, and will point out the door to their home. Yet they do not enjoy the right to return. So obviously, this is a double standard of immense proportions. The other thing BB talked about right off as he started was about King David, who reigned some 3,000 years ago, and here we are today as his descendants. What's interesting is, besides the fact that there is no historical evidence that King David ever existed outside the Bible, which of course is not a historical document, and Israeli archaeologists have all but turned up the entire country to find proof that he ever existed. Today, as we speak, an entire town, an entire community is being kicked out of their homes and forced into exile through violence, in order to prove that King David existed in a place called Silwan. It's a community of 50,000 people, right outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. Yet the world sees nothing wrong with this. American money is poured into this project to build what is called the New City of David, an archaeological park. And a community of 50,000 Palestinians has to be terrorized in order to leave. Their homes are being destroyed in order to make this point. This fictional, mythical connection between the ancient kingdom of King David and today's Israel. So these are just two examples. And it was interesting that Bibi Netanyahu decided to kick off his speech at the United Nations with these two things. But what I'd like to do today is just begin with a little bit of history. And if you go ahead, hit the first slide. Thank you. People talk about the fact that this conflict, the conflict in the Holy Land, the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians has been around for so long that it's really not something anybody can ever solve. It's been going on for thousands of years. People.
Oops, I made a boo-boo there and I can't correct it without doing it all over again. There's supposed to be three parts to this talk, and they were labeled 1, 2, 3, but in reality there's only one part that appeared. Sorry about that. But that gives you an idea of what's going on. And it also gives you an idea of how they've used the Bible as a history book instead of what it is, propaganda book. And then the ridiculous statement that millions of Christians believe that they're God's chosen people. God's chosen people. Yeah. How odd, you know, like Rockwell said, how odd of God to choose the Jews. I wonder how many of you people out there have been threatened by Christians before, like I have hundreds of times, that if you don't back and support the Jewish people, God will condemn you and cast you into the lake of fire that you've got to. The big spook in the sky says absolutely. Now that is really, I think they should be taken to court. I think anybody that threatens you like that should be taken to court and take their money away from them. What do you think? I think it'd be a good case because they've got to have evidence. I mean, they should, if it was a reasonable court, which most courts are not reasonable, unfortunately, that if that is the situation, then the evidence should be available. That if you kick the Jews' ass, God's going to kick your ass. Well, there have been a hell of a lot of people kicked Jews' ass for a long, long time, and most of them never got their ass kicked. And if you want to get down and dirty about it, you can say that the numbers of Jews that died during World War II was a giant, super kick in the ass by clodhoppers or cowboy boots or loggers' boots or whatever. Now, everyone has to admit that these blacks in Africa have been there a long, long time. And the people, the blacks who live in the Congo, have been there a hell of a long time. Now, this is out of the Congo, this story. Goma, a city in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. I love it the way all these dictatorships call themselves Democratic Republic. They try to cover all the bases. Sits by one of the world's largest freshwater reservoirs and has some of Africa's heaviest annual rainfall, yet it is a thirsty place. Most of the city's 1 million residents living close to the shores of Lake Kivu have to struggle every day to fetch water home. From daybreak, an endless stream of cyclists heads to the lake and back, filling battered containers with as much water as they can carry. In a makeshift shelter, health worker Fedeline Kabuhu tries to ensure that no container leaves without a dose of chlorine, which she injects with a syringe to make sure the water residents collect is potable. The people drink this water. They do everything with this water, the 46-year-old French charity worker said. And one little thing I might add to that is that chlorine can cause cancer, which they found out through study and of the dead soldiers in Vietnam, of young American soldiers that were cut open after they were dead to check them out, and they found that they already had hardening of the arteries started, and they were in their 20s, whereas the local Vietnamese that were killed, who had been drinking straight out of the rice paddy with no filtration at all, were perfectly clear on the inside. So not only these people can't figure a way of getting a pipe and a pump and all that to get water from this super reservoir, but now their health worker is poisoning them with chlorine. Amen. Now, how can people write this off as being oppression? I mean, sure, there's oppression, but sometimes this stuff affects even tribal leaders and people that have a little power in these areas that they haven't figured out in the hundreds of thousands of years how to get that water from the lake over to their village. And you're saying we're equal? You say, well, look around here today. Look at the blacks today. Well, yeah, they benefit by every advancement the white race has ever met. And Asian benefit, because they create things too and invent things too. But the black race, it's been living off the advancement in most cases of the white race forever, since they've been here, since they've been in Europe or any place else. And so they could say, well, they're equal because, look, they can drive a car too. Well, am I being a horrible, horrible hater when I put things like this out? These are facts. It's not imagination. And they don't have answers for it, except they can say oppression. They always say, oh, it's because they've been held down. But I used to always say, well, why were they held down? Well, what do you mean? Well, any group of people that have been enslaved has the opportunity, through using whatever method, to rise up and butcher their enslavers. Even some blacks have done that in the past. But blacks generally do not. And Mongol Asians usually rise up and throw off a slave master sooner or later. And even the whites in Soviet Union finally did it. Not soon enough, but they did it. But blacks can actually flourish under slavery. And there's plenty of proof of that. Well, they tell me that the Pentagon is preparing for a worldwide meltdown. Well, it's probably in conjunction with a worldwide economic meltdown and the meltdown of the dollar. But, you know, we hear this stuff all the time. Now, here's a guy talking about the differences between demonstrators and unconventional warfare or guerrilla fighters. I'm not sure what he's going to say, but let's listen to him.
That set out to discover why protesters don't become terrorists.
This is a really interesting study because this is where they really did blur the boundaries a lot. So originally the study was supposed to be focused on looking at what are the things that kind of stop peaceful activists who support so-called radical causes, to quote the project, what stops them from getting involved in kind of crossing that line and becoming involved in some kind of terrorist activity or some kind of political violence. So the idea was that what they'll do is analyze normal everyday kind of social movements, peaceful NGOs, to try and understand what is it that stops them from becoming involved in political violence. But what was really interesting and disturbing about that project is that even though they kind of said that that's the point of the research, when they actually categorized these activists that they were studying, they specifically categorized peaceful activists as supporters of political violence. So even if you are not engaged in what might be described as political violence, if you're a member of a group that is in somehow questioning the status quo or calling into question government policy or being active on the environment or calling into question corporate policies, then you could be seen as a supporter of political violence. So this is really what was really disturbing about this, was the way in which the boundaries between activism, social movements, and kind of radical causes were somehow being equated with terrorist activity or a threat to national security, which is really worrying. And there's absolutely no grounds for that kind of conclusion to be drawn when we look at who is actually involved in terrorist activity.
What, in your mind, are the biggest dangers of weaponizing social science and cultural anthropological studies?
Well, I think one of the biggest dangers, of course, is that by absorbing civilian institutions into what is actually a very narrow, parochial military agenda, what is happening is that objective, independent social science scholarship is, on these issues is being prevented. Instead, we have this, and I've experienced this myself, and my colleagues in social science have experienced it, where there is now this, there's people are, academics like anybody, independent media or anyone, activists are, they need money, they need funding for their research. Now all the big money is coming from the security industry and the defense industry, so you have the defense industry in effect controlling the discourse, controlling the discourse on counterterrorism, on security studies, on international politics. These are crucial subject areas that students are going into, they're learning from, and the idea really is that we want our students to be getting an independent and impartial understanding which can input in a meaningful way into policy, which can give policymakers good tools to really understand the way the world works and make good decisions. Instead, what's happening is we have this very narrow agenda, which is co-opting that discourse, co-opting that research, and really, constraining it. And that's where we have this very Orwellian trajectory towards controlling information and essentially determining what kind of truth is legitimate and what kind of truth is illegitimate.
Right, just using these studies to exploit the cultures that you want to, I guess, seize upon. The Minerva program is also being used as a method for studying societal breakdowns due to climate change. This is extremely fascinating. Considering that the Pentagon is the largest polluting institution in the world, why do you think defense officials are suddenly so interested in studying the societal impact of climate change?
Well, again, it's a very good question because, as we know, in terms of meaningful action to address climate change, scientists across the board have been telling us that, even our current emissions reductions targets are just not enough, and they will still guarantee disaster. And that even is, even the Obama administration's recent measures, which are most welcome, are still, again, within that danger trajectory. Mm-hmm. At the same time, however, we've got the Pentagon funding this kind of research, which is really about trying to track, well, what are the consequences when climate change does happen? How is it going to make societies kind of more vulnerable to, the kind of extreme weather events that we've been seeing over the last few years? How is that going to make them more vulnerable? And what kind of planning do we need to put in place to ensure that Western interests, U.S. interests, aren't damaged? And this takes me back to the Ministry of Defense research that I was talking about, which, of course, is very, very interrelated with the Pentagon. We have a special relationship here with the U.S. and the U.K., and that research is looking very much at how we need to maintain the functioning of the global economy and access to distant resources, access to potentially endangered supply chains in the context of climate change, in the context of all of these other kind of uncertainties such as energy depletion or economic crisis. So this is really about how do we maintain business as usual? How do we keep the system going when costs are increasing, when dangers are increasing? How do we and also, of course, when that's making more and more people angry and upset and they want change, how do we keep things going? And how can we be aware of where those things are going to hit and where those vulnerabilities are going to hit in the future so we can be prepared? So this is actually, again, about empowering the existing system, which is actually creating these crises, rather than transforming that system so that we can somehow prevent or mitigate those crises and actually maybe transform things for the benefit of most of the people on the planet. Instead, this is about really, in effect, this is a defense manifesto for the 1%.
Right, right. No, exactly. And on the other hand, you see the establishment actively suppressing the information about climate change. This is highly disturbing, Nazis. You wrote an article about the IPCC which is the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel that releases the most comprehensive reports on climate change. But according to your article, these reports have actually been diluted thanks to pressure from the world's superpower countries. Talk specifically about how these reports are diluted and what evidence there is that this is happening.
So there's been a number of reports talking about how the various elements of the IPCC summaries for policymakers have been diluted. So that doesn't apply to the large body of technical reports, which is like goes into thousands of pages. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is the summary documents which are presented to policymakers, and that's supposed to obviously determine the policies that are then decided and, you know, what we need to do to mitigate climate change, etc. The problem is that the policymakers themselves appear to be actually influencing what they're being presented in those summaries. So what's actually been happening, and this goes across, there's been a lot of debate about the mitigation reports, but less attention has been paid to the actual scientific assessments for the impact of climate change. So the article that I wrote was looking at information that I got from a guy called David Wasdor, who was previously a reviewer of the IPCC in 2007. And this time round, he had contact with a number of leading scientists who were involved in that process, where the working groups were liaising with policymakers to finalise the summary. And in that, he said that he gave quite a lot of detail, actually, in how a number of leading, most very powerful countries, who happened to be the countries that were most responsible for greenhouse gases, and he said this were the United States, China, Saudi Arabia. Interestingly, he said Saudi Arabia actually led the kind of push to really water down these summaries. And he said that what they were trying to do was dilute the extent to which the impacts of climate change were seen to be leading to drastic consequences in terms of the need for greenhouse gas reductions. So that was the upshot. And they actually asked for certain diagrams to be removed, and they called for certain diagrams which were projecting emissions, the emissions trajectory over the next couple of decades. They wanted that to be watered down, and they also wanted detailed data on the nature of greenhouse gas reductions that were required over the next few decades to be watered down as well. So this was very, very worrying, and a lot of independent academics who were members of these working groups, and who were giving advice at many stages of these processes, actually came on the record in a number of publications, not just The Guardian, and actually confirmed that this was happening, and they were very worried that there was a real effort here by the most powerful polluters in the world to essentially water down the kind of policy prescriptions that might be asked upon them in order to avoid dangerous climate change.
It's just unbelievable that we can't even trust the UN to provide the severity and scope of the problem here in Nafis. I know that you responded to Russell Brand's call for revolution. I wanted to wrap this up by kind of getting your assessment on what the hell we can do. Is it just a matter of completely operating outside the system at this point, Nafis?
I recently interviewed a really interesting guy by the name of Robert Steele, who has an exemplary record in the intelligence community. He's a former CIA case officer, and he also co-founded the U.S. Marine Intelligence Command, which is one of the major U.S. intelligence agencies. And this guy basically is a pioneer of what is known as open source intelligence, which is effectively not gaining intelligence through secret methods, but gaining intelligence through public information, public sources, whether it's open research, universities or research that is held in some form in the public domain and using that to inform decisions. And what he's argued is that most of the intelligence that is gained from secret methods is actually largely useless. And he says only 3-4% of it is actually operationally useful. So most information that's actually useful for decisions at a government level is actually open source. And he's been campaigning for this for a lifetime. And in his interview with me, he actually said that he believes that the preconditions for revolution, and by that he meant a complete overhaul of the existing system, is actually present in the United States and in Britain and in many Western countries. And he based this on his graduate thesis that he did in 1970, and he produced a very interesting kind of matrix on the preconditions of revolution, which you can find on my Guardian article, which is available online. And he basically said that he believes that all we need really is a trigger, effectively, for something like our version of a Tunisian fruit seller. That trigger that's going to really catalyze people to take action. And I asked him, what's to prevent this from becoming, something which is quite regressive and violent. And, as we've seen in with the Arab Spring, things haven't exactly gone very well over there. In fact, things are in many ways going backwards. And he said, there's no guarantee of that sort of thing, but he said there's a lot of reason to hope. If we look at a lot of the developments that are happening in politics and in economy, in ideology, in information, he's been highlighting actual real-life changes that are going on now, where we've seen participatory methods opening up and new innovations in how to organize ourselves socially, how to mobilize on social media, how to basically develop kind of new ways of doing things economically, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's virtual currencies, whether it's using the internet to communicate with each other. He's pointed to a whole range of really exciting new paradigms that are currently emerging.
I think he's dead on, and so are you, Nafiz. You're constantly writing these mind-blowing articles for The Guardian. Everyone check it out. Nafiz Ahmed, thank you so, so much for sharing your insight on the world.
Tick, 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 tock. You're reading between the lines there. Now, I put a lot of stuff on that you don't have to agree with everything I put on, but in between the lines, read between the lines. I don't even have to say worse is better anymore, because worse is worse. And the big money, the 1%ers, the 2%ers are gearing up like Gulliver in Gulliver's Travels to fight the Lilliputians. You look at Israel right now, Israel is becoming Gulliver, and the Lilliputians are slowly strapping down Israel like a spider web. So guess who's going to be their next chosen client state? The United States corporations? Saudi Arabia. That's going to be the big corporate client state. Yes, it is. You got that from Tommy. I love these stories. Washington and Lee University administrators have agreed to remove Confederate flags from the campus chapel after protests from a group of Negroid law students. The flags, various Confederate battle flags captured by the surrendered to the Union Army during the Civil War, have been on display in the main chamber of Lee Chapel since 1930. The ones being replaced are replicas, placed on display in 1995 after the American Civil War Museum, which owns the flags, removed the originals due to deterioration from the way they were being displayed. Best known as a symbol of the pro-slavery South, capitalist South. Why don't you put that in there? They never say that. The flag reappeared during the Civil Rights Movement as a symbol against desegregation. In other words, it was a symbol of white racial separation. You go your way, we'll go our way. Today it is commonly used by white supremacists and other extremist groups. The Southern Poverty Law Center, oh boy, counts more than 500 extremist groups that include the flag as part of their symbol. And the rest of them all use swastikas. Do you think that Morris Dees lays awake at night worrying about this? He lays awake at night counting the monies fleeced off the stupid people out there. Millions and millions. He's laying there in bed with his wife with her plastic dress on. I don't know whether you ever saw that. That's the most bizarre thing I ever saw. His wife was featured in a newspaper there in Montgomery in some kind of a see-through plastic dress. She's just as crazy as Morris is. a group of 12 black students at the University Law School had pushed. I'm sure they didn't have to push very hard, because if they had, somebody would have probably pushed them back. Anyhow, the school's administration for changes charging that the school is unwelcoming to underrepresented students, especially blacks. Well, that's probably true. They probably don't want any more blacks than they have to let in to get under the law. The students warned of organized acts of civil disobedience if the university did not take action before the new semester begins in September. Well, that's a threat of violence, right? Now, if you are in a white group, which I hope you're not, I hope you're an individual, but if you were, and if you go down there and threaten violence if they don't keep the flags up, what do you think would happen? You know what would happen. Quote, they assured me it was a welcoming environment where everyone sticks together as a community, student Dominic Taylor said. Quote, then I came here and I felt ostracized and alienated. They promised me a white girlfriend, a white bitch, and I couldn't get one. But in a message to the university community last week, President Kenneth P. Roscusio said many traditions will remain in place. Yeah, like race mixing, passing people with grades that they don't deserve, all that kind of stuff. First established by pioneers in 1749, the Lexington, Virginia School is the ninth oldest higher learning institution in the United States, named Washington Academy after the nation's first president, saved the school from financial ruin in 1796 with an endowment. The university has a history that includes owning and selling slaves, but this is often hidden by school administrators. In 1826, Washington College came into possession of between 70 and 80 enslaved Negroes from the estate of jockey John Robertson. President Roscusio noted in his letter, until 1852, the institution benefited from their enslaved labor and in some cases from the sale. I think that John Robertson is the one they modeled the jockey that people had on their lawns, the black jockey. A lot of people don't know it, if it's the same guy, but they did that out of respect for his ability as a jockey. He went to France. He lived in France. He became a top jockey. And so here about 20 years ago, they said everybody's got to take their black jockeys off their front yard, when in fact it was originally as a tribute to John Robinson. The university will continue to study its historic involvement with slavery. Well, what about white slavery? We acknowledge that this was a regrettable chapter in our history, and we promise never to do it again unless conditions present themselves. And we must confront and try to understand this chapter as we kiss the ass of the Negroes, African Americans. At Washington and Lee, we learn from the past. No, you learn from the Jews and their liberal friends. And this is an episode which there is much to learn. Yeah, how can we mix the white race totally with the blacks? As long as we've got those flags hanging on the goddamn wall. Get those flags down there. Quote, we are committed to telling the university's history accurately, including the stories of many individuals who should not be overlooked, like a lot of the blacks that graduated from the college that became corrupt criminals, or maybe were involved in the Reconstruction corruption that ran the states into the ground after the Civil War. That process is now underway through a special working group that is initially convened last fall and has begun to develop a timeline of the history of the African Americans at the university and to explore other ways in which we can illuminate and recognize this history and work 24 hours a day to find out something positive that they contributed. The fight to end slavery in America, which they didn't end slavery, they ended chattel slavery, at least some of it, but they installed wage slavery, which is far worse than chattel slavery, is another significant part of the school history that protested students say the school doesn't approach in a respectful manner. They sure don't talk about wage slavery, do they? Because the wages in the South have always been extremely low, which replaced chattel slavery. Confederate General Robert E. Lee accepted an appointment as the school's president in 1865. Just 6 months after surrendering at Appomattox, he served until his death in 1870 and is buried on the school grounds. To honor his leadership, the school changed its name to Washington and Lee University shortly after Lee's death. Well, let's see here. Now, what did the Negroes say about this? The students sought a formal apology from the school for Lee's racist and dishonorable conduct, a request denied by the school's president. I don't think that Robert E. Lee was called a very vicious, racist type like Tom Metzger. I think he was a West Point graduate who screwed up in two or three battles that lost the Civil War. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. That was at where? The one there in the east. Charge, everybody, right up the hill into the cannons. That's the way we'll win this war. And I don't know whether he was involved in Vicksburg, at least advising or not, but Vicksburg was another stupid tragedy of thinking the Union naval people could not sneak by the bluffs of Vicksburg and come in from the south. Hitler made the same mistake at Dunkirk, and he made the same mistake at D-Day. You always have to assume the worst from your enemy, like the Viet Cong in Vietnam, who had experienced fighting about everybody, and the French were trying to hold on, Dien Bien Phu, and a few thousand of those Viet Cong type marched through mud and torrential rains up almost insurmountable mountains with cannons on their backs and came down to wipe the French out at Dien Bien Phu. Don't ever underestimate your enemy. Don't overestimate him, but don't underestimate him. Anyhow, that's it for now, and hope you've enjoyed the show, and go on out there and recruit some more people to get the show. Because a lot of this stuff is late news, hot off the old presses, man. 14-5, and just say, shut up. Don't let them in your house without a warrant. Keep them on the porch. They want you to go downtown and question you. Unless they got a warrant or you're under arrest, don't go with them. Don't play the opposition's game. Ever.